It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll take stock of standardized testing in Wisconsin and beyond and hear about a growing movement that's calling for less emphasis on those mandatory tests.
Right now, we're continuing our series of candidate forums here on Central Time, and today we're taking a look at the race for the state's 6th congressional district. It's the district's first open race in decades, with veteran Congressman Tom Petri announcing that he's not seeking another term.
There are three candidates looking to take that seat. We've already heard from Libertarian Gus Ferendorf, and Democratic candidate Mark Harris will join us in just a moment. The Republican candidate in the race is Glenn Grothman. He was unable to join us for an interview here on Central Time.
So we turn to Mark Harris now. He's the Winnebago County Executive and the Democratic candidate in the race for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. He joins us by phone. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Veronica, it's my pleasure.
So, Mark, we're going to start with the same question we just asked our Libertarian candidate. Why are you running for this seat for Congress?
Well, I want to address the fiscal situation in Washington in an intelligent way, and I also want to seek real solutions to the real problems that people care about, things such as preserving Social Security in its present form for current and future retirees.
Now, Wisconsin's 6th congressional district seat has been held by Republicans since 1967, so it seems fair to say that you may be facing an uphill battle in this race. With that in mind, how are you trying to win over this district's voters?
Well, while the district has traditionally been Republican, it's had a very moderate Republican in this office for a long time, Tom Petri. Tom was a quiet, soft-spoken, effective congressperson, and you know, he was a sponsor of the Earned Income Tax Credit. He did lunch counter sit-ins with the NAACP in his early years. He was a truly moderate Republican. I'm a very moderate Democrat, and my opponent has, you know, staked out a position on the far right for this election. And I think the voters are going to decide that I'm much more like Tom Petri, I'm much more like the people they've traditionally sent to Washington than my opponent is.
Now, across the board, from state Senate to Congress, there are two big issues that have emerged of importance for a lot of people who are watching, and those are jobs and the economy. So we'll start off with jobs. What role do you think Congress can play in spurring job creation in Wisconsin and beyond?
Well, most new jobs come from small and startup companies, and the problem they're having is that there's very little access to venture capital or working capital. So what the federal government can do is help out with the credit needs for those businesses, perhaps through the Small Business Administration.
And since the recession, the economy has bounced back some. People would maybe like to see more from the economy. As a member of Congress, what would you do to accelerate the pace of economic recovery?
Well, certainly what we talked about with the lack of credit for small and growing businesses. But I think raising and indexing the minimum wage could also stimulate the economy. The proposal I make is a little different than the one you hear most of the time. I would like to see us index minimum wage to about 42% of the prior year's average hourly wage. And then any time it would drop below 40% of the prior year average hourly wage, that it would automatically be adjusted back to 42%.
And as far as the federal budget goes, there are concerns about the growing national debt and some people saying the government is spending too much money. What policies would you pursue to get that budget back on track?
Well, I think there is a recovery going on, and that is generating increases in revenues. And we have to make sure that the bulk of those new and increasing revenues are used to close the gap between what we're bringing in revenue and what we're spending. Now, there actually was some good news in the last fiscal year that just ended at the end of September, and that's that the deficit for that year was about $483 billion. That's an enormous amount of money, but really less than what was expected as a deficit, and it seems to be on a favorable trend. So where we are right now is that, you know, for fiscal 2014, we spent about $4 trillion and brought in about $3.5 trillion. For 2015, we want that gap to be smaller. And perhaps the receipts will come in $3.6, $3.7 trillion. and spending might be as high as 4.2. But we've got to gradually close that gap, but in a way that doesn't cause a recession.
Are there particular spending cuts that you would want to pursue?
Oh, there's isolated items that you can find. There was a jet fighter that was so modified by the different forces that in the end it ended up being too heavy for its single engine. The program should just be scrapped. You now have a jet that nobody wants. You can find isolated instances. I think we have to continue to hold back on earmarks, and that's where individual congressmen get specific spending for their districts. I don't think we're in a position to continue doing that. We need to hold those back. But the real secret is just making sure that the new revenues that come about as a result of growth in the economy are devoted to closing that gap between the receipts and the expenses.
And if you got to Congress and the numbers weren't adding up the way you liked, would you be in support of raising taxes?
Not income taxes. I'm not income tax increase. But I would be willing to increase the maximum wage base subject to the Social Security taxes because we need to ensure that the Social Security system is solvent in its present form for current and future retirees. So I would be willing to see that wage base raised in order to keep that system strong.
Now, on a related budget note, as we talk about things like Social Security and Medicare, they face an unclear future at the moment. What do you think needs to happen specifically in order for these programs to stay solvent?
Well, Medicare is the tougher of the two problems. And one of the things that can be done with Medicare is to allow it to bargain on pharmaceutical prices, and that would result in a substantial savings and would help improve its condition. With regard to Social Security, you know, Social Security has actually collected something like $2.7 trillion more than it's paid out. The problem is more of a long-term problem. With changes in the demographics, the number of people working will drop to a lower ratio to the number retired than it had been in the past. You know, perhaps over time dropping to like 2 or 1.8 workers per retiree. And when that happens, you need to have more money injected into the system to make sure the full benefits can be paid, or else the benefits would have to drop to 70% of the promised level. The first step to doing that is raising that maximum wage base. And it's actually drifted below the percentage of wages it used to cover in the past. At one time, it covered 90% of all wages. Now there's a great deal of wages beyond that maximum, so it needs to be readjusted.
We're talking right now with congressional candidate Mark Harris. He's a Democratic candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. If you've got a question for Mark or you're wondering where he stands on a particular issue, you could reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Mark Harris. He's the Democratic candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. If you've got a question for Mark or you want to hear his thoughts on a particular issue, you can reach us right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. And we'll take a caller now. We've got Marilyn joining us from Milwaukee. Hey, Marilyn.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Harris.
Hi.
I have a question regarding taxation for large corporations, something that was rescinded a while back. I'm not totally familiar with it, and no doubt you are, but taxation for all corporations.
Well, one of the things that's been in the news a lot lately is that our top marginal tax rate is higher than many foreign countries, but most foreign countries have a flat corporate rate, and the U.S. federal rate is a graduated rate. So if you take the average amount paid by corporations, it really is not above the foreign countries, But if for competitive reasons we need to, we could go to a flatter corporate tax rate, one that didn't have as high a top rate, but didn't have as low of beginning rates. You could even go to a flat rate, perhaps 20%, and you'd be competitive with foreign countries. I do have, though, problems with always giving breaks to large businesses, and or maybe making breaks in narrow categories for business. For instance, at the state level here, my opponent has passed tax credits that will virtually eliminate income tax on manufacturing and agriculture, and then the rest of the state is going to be left holding the bag when the state revenues are insufficient to cover their bills. And I would hate to see the same thing happen at a federal level, well, where one category of corporation or business is selected to have all of their taxes eliminated with other people left to make up their share.
Thank you for that call, Marilyn. Appreciate it. And you can join us with your questions for Mark Harris at 800-642-1234. Now, when the next Congress convenes, immigration is another big issue on the table. There seems to be bipartisan agreement that some reform is needed, but there is not consensus between the parties on how exactly to accomplish that. So what are your thoughts on changing, fixing the immigration system?
Well, first off, let me say that some people are looking at immigration incorrectly. They're worried about people coming across the border from Mexico, and that is one aspect of immigration, and we do need to gain control of our border. But there's many other aspects of immigration, and in fact, something like 44% of the new startups in Silicon Valley are by foreign-born individuals. We also have many people in our universities here that have learned hard-to-find skills attending our universities, and we're making them go home when we really need them to enhance our economy here. And what happens is you send them home, and they end up creating businesses that compete with us and grow jobs in their home countries rather than growing jobs here. Wisconsin, in 6th District in particular, has a lot of agriculture. Most of our cows are milked by foreign-born individuals. Much of our crops are harvested by foreign individuals. And there can be positive aspects of immigration. So the way to address this is to have an expanded guest worker program so that we can make sure that people are working above the table for fair wages and with the right safety standards, and to look for those immigrants that are going to benefit our economy and possibly grow employment opportunities for all of us. So it can be a positive thing if it's done right.
Now, moving on, we're going to take a look at health care next. As it stands, the Affordable Care Act is law, and unless it's repealed, it's not going to go away anytime in the near future. How do you feel about the law? Are you happy with it?
Well, I'm open-minded to consider reasonable, constructive modifications of the law. There's a few issues of it. I certainly think when people go to the website to sign on, they need to have more information about the availability of physicians under the options before them in their area. But there's some things that are really good about the Affordable Care Act that we kind of forget that they're in there. For instance, being able to cover our children to age 26 through our employer, eliminating the lifetime $1 million cap that so many insurance policies had in the past, so that if you have a chronic illness, you don't run out of insurance before you've recovered. And also the pre-existing conditions that used to make it so hard for someone with a sick family member to change jobs, because changing jobs could cause them to lose their health insurance. People forget how bad those situation was before those problems were addressed by the Affordable Care Act. So there's good things in the Affordable Care Act that should be preserved, and it would be just plain crazy to throw the whole thing out, without having a suitable alternative ready to put in its place. So I say, let's make improvements to it, let's make it better, but let's not throw it out and have to start all over again.
Well, we'll move to our callers now, and we have Jim on the line joining us from Franklin. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
My question has to do with the Affordable Care Act. Why are our federal employees, why are our state employees, why are our congressmen, why are our senators and people holding office not required to, you know, given the option to be on the Affordable Care Act,
or given
options, you know, as part of their hiring? You know, if they're working for the state, federal government, this is a, federal Health Care Act, why aren't they being covered rather than spending, you know, vast amounts of money for other private ones?
Got your question, Jim. Thank you. And Mark Harris, what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm a county executive. My employees are covered largely under the health insurance that we offer through the county. They do contribute towards that insurance. But I suppose an option the county would have would be to end our insurance and then allow the employees to seek coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, the county would then have to pay taxes for not providing that insurance. So it's an option you could look at. Personally, I'm satisfied with the private insurance that the...
Okay, and we're going to move on to foreign policy now. One of the biggest threats that's currently facing the United States is the terrorist group ISIS, and the next Congress will have some big decisions about how to handle that threat and how to proceed. Would you authorize the use of American military force against the group?
You know, I think it would be a mistake to send in U.S. ground troops. And again, you know, the ISIS situation developed over a long time, but what it stems from is the Sunni population in Iraq feeling excluded from the central government when Maliki was in charge. And it was something that was foreseeable because it was a democracy. He depended on the votes of the Shiite majority to retain power, and the Shiite majority was under heavy influences from Iran. And it was inevitable that the Sunni population would feel discriminated against and that they would, in fact, be discriminated against under that system. So there was a power vacuum with nobody representing the Sunni. And unfortunately, by having that lack of representation and power, that allowed an extremely radical group to step in their place. So the first step to ending the ISIS problem would be constructing some sort of alternative for the Sunni community to ISIS. I do support airstrikes at this time, but I do not think putting American boots on the ground would be the right decision for us. And, you know, the same type of Sunni-Shia strife is playing out in neighboring Syria, where President Assad is from a Shia group, Alawites, and the majority of the population is Sunni. And that's really the conflict that underlies all these other conflicts.
As we wrap up, Mark, can you please leave us with your final message to voters?
Well, you know, there's a Kennedy quote that I want to use to guide me on how my behavior should be as a congressperson. And it goes something like, don't look for the Republican answer. Don't look for the Democratic answer. Look for the right answer. And don't spend your energies on recriminations of the past. Accept responsibility for the future. And that's kind of the philosophy I want to guide me as a congressman.
And any final priorities you would have for the 6th Congressional District?
Well, I've mentioned protecting Social Security. I've mentioned indexing and raising the minimum wage. I also want to find an adequate, dedicated source of funding for the Highway Trust Fund. And I also want to work on making college more affordable. Part of that issue is more reasonable rates of interest for student loans.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Mark Harris is the Winnebago County Executive and the Democratic candidate in the race for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District seat.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. In a moment, we'll look at the renewed debate over the amount of testing in American schools.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Taylor Johnson's family has harvested lumber in northern Wisconsin for generations. While other loggers have embraced modern equipment, Taylor's found value in logging with a team of horses in winter's cold and summer's heat.
Think about it, like less than 100 years ago or about 100 years ago, we leveled this whole country with horses. Much bigger timber than we have now. Now, some of the other loggers think I'm crazy. You know, they don't know why I would possibly want to do this and work like this when there's much easier ways. You know, they wouldn't work in this kind of cold and, you know, in the heat of the summer and deal with the bugs when they're sitting in air-conditioned cabs. They don't want to go back, really. Right now, I'm just sharpening the chain. I'm going to take this tree because you can see it's damaged. It was probably hit by a plow or something years ago. It just gets a little worse every year. And if I don't take it and some of these other smaller ones, it's going to get bug kill because it's weakened. So then if it gets diseased, it'll pass the disease on to the other trees that are still healthy. This is Mark. He's about 9 years old. I've had him since he was 4. And I got him. He'd never been in the woods. And he's a very good horse, very good horse. He weighs about a ton. And he can get a lot of work done in a day. He's a good boy. Oh boy. I can get around within in a 5 foot opening or a 38 inch opening with a single horse and get logs out. The smallest machines they have nowadays are 10 feet wide. Everything in the industry keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I can literally log almost anything in the country with what's right in this little trailer. If I have to get something done, I try to avoid the roads like in busy times of the day because otherwise I can't get anything done. Everybody stops to talk. What's really kind of neat is like some of the old guys, especially in the Hayward area, there's a lot of older guys that had grown up doing this, and they get almost emotional if they stop and watch because it brings back so many memories. I'm going to probably do this until I die. I think I'm not going to retire. I don't have any plans to retire. And my grandfather sawed wood until he was in his 80s. If I can do that, I'll be happy. If I can work until I'm in my 70s or 80s, then I'll worry about it then. I'll worry about retirement then.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30 p.m. You can also head over to wisconsinlife.org or search for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
We take a look now at a growing movement in the education world. All across the nation, kindergarten through 12th grade students have to take tests, a lot of them in some cases. That's got parents and educators wondering how much is too much.
Well, change could be coming. Last week, state education chiefs and district superintendents announced a plan to re-examine their assessment systems in an effort to find out what tests are working and which ones could be eliminated. It's a plan that's got the support of Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who traditionally has been an advocate of test-based accountability.
Joining us now to look at the renewed debate over testing is Erin Richards. She's education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to the show.
Hello, thanks.
Well, now we're not talking about the weekly science quiz and things like that. We're talking about these tests offered by state and the national government. How much of a testing load are schools and kids facing when it comes to those tests?
Well, some of it is the same kind of testing requirements we've had for years. So, for example, in Wisconsin, kids in third grade through eighth grade, and then once in high school in 10th grade, take the annual state achievement test. We're really concerned with the results in reading and math because of the No Child Left Behind law and federal mandates that look specifically at how schools are performing in reading and math. But that state test also tests other subjects like social studies and science. And so what in our state, the Wisconsin Knowledge and Concepts Examination has been this yearly test that you take if you're in those grades, in those subjects. But that's going to be replaced this year, this spring, by a new state test that's tied to the Common Core state standards. So it's a new test, but it's replacing the old test. So that's one that people often refer to as a high-stakes test, because a lot rides on that test, because we use it to judge schools. Eventually, teachers' performance evaluations, may be tied to the results of those tests. In addition to that, there are some other tests that have been approved by the state. One of them is an early literacy screener. It's a kind of a weird word, but it essentially means that in the youngest grades, around kindergarten or first grade, teachers are administering a one-on-one test with young kids to see what they know about early literacy skills. Do you know the alphabet? Can you make out some sounds? And that's supposed to be a better diagnostic tool so that we know how young kids are doing and maybe we can get them intervention help even sooner. On the other end of the spectrum, in high school, we've got a new suite of tests through the ACT group, which most of us know. ACT, usually you take that in your junior year. It's a college entrance exam. You get a score on it out of 36. Helps you get into college if you score, better colleges if you score higher on it. So that's also considered a high-stakes test. But it's now mandatory in the state. All juniors have to take it. The state is going to pay for it. And then they're also going to implement these other tests related to to preparing for that ACT in 9th and 10th grade.
And now on top of all that, I hear about MAPS testing from my kids.
Yes. So this is another test that a lot of districts around the country and in Wisconsin have implemented. MAP is a little bit different because it's given three times a year. It's pretty quick. Kids take it on the computer, but if your technology is not great, that can pose some other issues. And it's literally a way to see from when the child starts in September or October to where they finish at the end of the year, how much growth they actually made over the course of the year. But once again, that's a lot of time spent preparing for those tests, figuring out how to take those tests, and ultimately, doing something with the results.
So as we mentioned, there's starting to be some pushback. What are we hearing in Wisconsin and across the country when it comes to that burden of time and effort in administering all these tests?
A little bit of finger pointing, first of all. So the state, their response has been, we're on board with this effort by these two national groups to evaluate the kinds of tests we have on the table right now and to make sure that they're all necessary. But they've also the State Department of Public Instruction in Wisconsin is also saying, the only one we're really requiring is the state test. To which schools are saying, yeah, but we've got to give this test. We've got to get, the early literacy screener takes time. The ACT suite, while it might be a good move, also takes a lot of time. So schools and districts are saying, hey, wait a minute. We're just responding to mandates here. We don't have a lot of control over how much we're supposed to do. So that's one element. There's a lot of sort of who's responsible for all this. And then I would say that schools and districts are also responding to parent concerns about how much of this testing is really necessary. And frankly, if you talk to kids, a lot of them are not putting their heart and soul into every test that they take. They know that some of them are more important than others. It doesn't really make a difference to them if they don't do great on the state assessment. That's going to be used to judge a school, not judge their chances of getting into college.
Yeah, can you talk about the function of all this testing? What are the different goals that we are trying to accomplish by having these different kind of tests?
Well, for a long time, the annual state tests are given to give some indication to states and the public how schools are doing in terms of their achievement snapshot. The issue is that in 2001, when we passed the No Child Left Behind law at a federal level, those reading and math tests, or the English and math tests, took on greater importance because not only were you going to look at those for every school, how all the kids on average did in them, but you were going to break out these subgroups of students. So we know that there's an achievement gap between kids of color and white students. We know there's an achievement gap between kids who are low income and not low income. And the No Child Left Behind law said you have to report how these subgroups of students are doing, which did a couple things. It brought some attention to the fact that a lot of those kids were not necessarily getting all the help they needed to be able to progress, but it also shifted much more of the attention onto the tests themselves and how important these were. And teachers were under a lot of pressure to make sure their test scores looked good, and principals too, for that matter.
And does that one accusation commonly is that if you've got a test with stakes that may affect school's funding or other things, that there's a temptation to teach to the test, not teach the skills you might have, but just try to teach students to be successful on that particular test?
Sure. And there are lots of, if you talk to teachers and principals, there are so-called tricks. You can look at exactly which of your students are on the bubble. You know, they're basic. They're not quite proficient. So maybe you're going to pour a lot of your resources into helping those kids get over the hump so you have more kids looking proficient in your school. Maybe that means that we're not giving as much attention to kids who are average achievers or high achievers because they're just not, they're going to do okay regardless. You could make an argument for that. On the other hand, I think a lot of people would say that part of part of what's underscoring some of these testing scandals that have happened around the country where someone says, oh my gosh, how could a teacher change test scores? Well, if you don't actually feel like those test scores are reflecting how, your student's real performance, I think that I think there are other pressures there that maybe people haven't fully understood because they're not in the thick of it.
We're talking with education reporter Aaron Richards about the role of testing in schools and whether or not maybe too much testing could be hurting American education. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think American students are being over-tested? If you're a teacher, how do you feel about these assessments? Are there changes you'd like to see made? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Aaron Richards of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the growing call to cut back on some of the testing in schools. You can join the conversation with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. As a parent, a teacher, a student, do you agree too much testing? Or do you think, hey, we need tests in place to show progress in students and in schools and in districts? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Chad on the line in Sheboygan. Chad, hi.
Hey, how's it going? This issue is so big, I don't even know where to start. I'm an English teacher in Sheboygan, and your guest actually hit it exactly on the head with a lot of the drawbacks to it. We've been going through a lot of this testing in Sheboygan in the last 2 weeks, and it has almost taken the school to a complete standstill. It shortens classes, and we got to remember it's not only about proctoring the tests, it's also about preparation for the test. All these things are done electronically now, and teachers have to go in and sign confidentiality agreements and all that kind of stuff. And the other big thing, and the guest already absolutely said this, was that the kids don't put as much stakes into this as it has for the schools. A lot of the kids, you'll see, I just proctored a test on Tuesday, and they'll do the test very quickly and put their head down, and that's it. They're done. We try to urge them and prepare them, of course, but also being an English teacher, I'm losing the time in order to help them with literacy, because of this testing, which, to widen the issue a little bit, is absolutely due to corporations controlling our politicians, and that's why the ACT suite, I think, is coming in. So I'll take my comments off here.
Chad, thanks for the call. Aaron, is that a common story you're hearing from teachers who are looking at administering these tests in their schools?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what teachers really, often what I'm hearing from teachers is I have so much less time to actually teach, develop my curriculum, come up with new and innovative ways of doing things because a lot more of my time is devoted to, like the caller said, preparing to administer these exams. I don't know what the answer is to generating excitement around these tests. I know that in Milwaukee, some of the schools that do have pretty high test scores managed to generate an enormous amount of sort of thrill among the students in taking these. I'm not exactly sure how they do it all the time, but there's pep rallies for tests. There's energy around, you know, trying to explain to the kids why these are so important. And sometimes I think that may be the key between schools that look better than others. They simply were able to get their students to, sort of take them seriously and try.
Let's get back to our callers. Thanks for that, Chad. We'll go to Lisa now in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hi. How are you?
What do you think about this, Lisa?
I teach kindergarten in a dual language program, and the in addition to all of the time and prep that goes into multiple tests, and you haven't even mentioned access testing for second language learners or CPAA, which is another test that we do with the young second language learners. All of these take time, and with the younger children, we have to do them individually. So I spend an enormous amount of time throughout the year, multiple times, pulling each student individually and working with them and doing all of this testing instead of working with groups of students or teaching or doing anything with them. So then it makes it very frustrating.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Lisa, in some ways, echoing some of what Chad had to say about the load of time, and she mentioned a couple other tests specific to English as a second language students, Aaron.
Yeah, and, you know, ESL students and also students with special needs take, oftentimes they take an alternate assessment, but there can sometimes be as much, if not more, time spent helping those students prepare for the test simply because they're not your traditional learner. You know, they need some accommodations. The very tests that are meant to identify their needs and help them are, in some ways, according to teachers and some parents, you know, sort of maybe holding them back.
We'll get back to our callers in just a moment. Thanks for that, Lisa. We mentioned earlier complaints from state education chiefs, urban superintendents wanting to review anyway the current status of testing. And then we had an op-ed from U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan kind of agreeing a little bit, it sounded like, with the people complaining about too much testing. What did he have to say?
Well, I think that move was fairly significant and spoke to teachers, although I do think it sent a bit of a mixed message. The Obama administration has been very focused on test-based accountability, sort of showing through data that you've been able to perform and will, you know, you can apply for grants or, you know, you're more likely to get money from us or support from us if you can show, you have evidence of what you're doing that's working. So for him to say, you know, I do think there has been some, that maybe all of this testing isn't doing exactly what we had hoped it to do or hoped it would do is a significant move. I think the problem is how do you move backwards from something that your administration has really advocated and that many states have signed on to? I mean, how do you back off of an early literacy test that the state in Wisconsin said just, you know, well, maybe 2 years ago, was exactly what we needed to help more kids be reading on grade level by third grade? And that's really hard. What's a better solution?
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Rick on the line in Grafton. Rick, hi.
How you doing? I'm a hiring manager in the IT industry, and my son's also in high school. And one thing I'm noticing is that a lot of the people coming out of college and a lot of the kids are really good at passing the paper tests. And then you throw them in the field, and it's like they've lost that ability to think on their own, to actually learn relevant things. I think the tests are narrowing it so much that once these kids get into the real world, they can't apply the skills that the, for lack of a better term, the pathway teachers taught actually brought a much better worker to the workforce.
Interesting, Rick. Thanks for that call. That speaks to maybe deeper issues of education philosophy and what we want kids to take out of their school experience, Aaron.
And, you know, at the same time that is a growing chorus, I mean, the Common Core State Standards, you know, advocates of them really say these are what we want. We want, you know, sort of fewer standards that make you think more deeply, make critical connections, do all of these things that maybe require you to, you know, write an essay instead of fill in a bubble or answer a short test. And we are seeing that some more of these tests coming out do require more sort of analytics. I mean, there's certainly an enormous amount of money wrapped up in the testing companies that write these questions and figure out ways to test kids differently. But certainly, I think there is kind of a growing chorus of, you know, if what we want to produce is innovative thinkers and people who can sort of do big picture things, is that most what kind of test would most accurately reflect that?
Back to our callers with Connie in Muskego now. Connie, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just had a comment from a parent perspective. We actually had our son in a school that did put a lot of emphasis on these tests. And the only time he struggles with ADHD, the only time that they would give him any extra attention would be to prep him for the test. And unfortunately, then he slipped through the cracks on all of the other academics. Why is it that the teachers are put to such a high standard to be able to maintain these test scores at the district? I guess that was the frustrating part. So what we did is we ended up switching him to another district where they didn't put the emphasis on those tests. And he is striving and doing much, much better at that school.
Wow, Connie, thanks for sharing your experience. Aaron, so a parent who actually moved to a different district that put little or less stock in this kind of testing.
You know, that's an interesting reaction, and she's certainly not alone. Another tactic parents have taken across the country, really in greater numbers than in Wisconsin, at least from what we've seen, is to simply opt their children out of certain tests. Parents have the ability to simply say, I do not want my child to take the state exam. It's rarely used. Most schools, well, in Wisconsin, as a school, you will actually get dinged on your state report card if you don't have 95% of your students take the test. That's because the fewer kids that take it, the less accurate, you know, the read is on the school, essentially. But there is a growing movement of parents who have simply said, I don't want my kid to participate. And so there's this whole opt-out movement, and some of that, you know, kind of growing chorus in other states has driven some of this as well.
Briefly, Aaron, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next in this story?
I think it will be really interesting to see what these two groups, the national organization that represents state school chiefs and the organization that represents urban superintendents, it will be really interesting to see if they actually follow through on this and come up with any meaningful recommendations. So I think simply just making sure that this isn't just sort of a call to appease frustrated parents and teachers that doesn't really result in anything. That will be interesting to watch. I think some critics have already suggested that this is just sort of a, you know, throwing a bone to the frustrated folks out there. So first thing to watch would be recommendations that actually come out of this and what our own state is going to do about it.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Aaron Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.